From Yosemite to the Grand Canyon, Fort Sumter to Gettysburg, Mount Rushmore to Haleakala, the National Park System has been called America's best idea, showcasing the country's stunning landscapes, its diverse wildlife, and its layered history, while providing spaces for Americans of all walks of life to come together to learn about and experience their country outdoors. In this episode, we're going to explore how our National Park System came to be, some of the lesser-known histories of some of our most famous parks, and what life at the parks looks like today. I'm Judy Woodruff. This is In Pursuit of Happiness. So joining me for today's conversation is Jason Epperson. Jason, it is so good to have you with us. For the last, decade or so, you and your wife, Abby, have been traveling the country, touring, I guess, in an RV and different vehicles. You've been visiting public land, seeing public parks, and you've been overseeing a few podcasts, RV Miles, America's National Parks, and now Parkography. It is so good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us where the fascination came with traveling, with wanting to know more about the country and then the parks.
Sure. So my wife and I and my three kids, I've got three boys, we lived in Chicago. I moved to Chicago to go to college, and I lived there for 16 years. And Abby and I met in school, so she was there about the same amount of time. And we were in the theater industry and barely had our eyes leave the city of Chicago. In fact, for a while, I think I hardly left a 3 or 4 block radius. We were really ingrained in what we were doing there. And over the course of the years, growing a family, we started getting excited about the idea of traveling the country a little bit. We had built a publication that was covering the theater industry in Chicago. We were doing sort of news and reviews and audition boards and things like that. And we had this idea that we were going to bring it to some other cities around the country. So we got a bug in our ear about traveling to sort of visit some of these cities and learn about their theater communities. We started on that journey by building out a school bus conversion. So you can buy school buses really cheaply. And we bought a 2002 Thomas school bus for, I think, $2,500. And over the course of a summer where I didn't have much work, I was I built that thing out for to make a makeshift RV for our family. It was a sort of popular thing, the Schoolie movement, it was called for a while. And our kids were homeschooled in the first place, so we knew we could travel for extensive periods, and we just decided that that's what we were going to do.
What an incredible education for your kids. And you clearly fell in love with the country, with what you were seeing out on the road. And this is a big country. So how did you decide? And I have to say that I am growing up, my family was not a park visiting family. We would drive long distances to visit grandparents and in Oklahoma and North Carolina and every place in between. We were living in Georgia for a long time and other parts of the country. I was raised as an Army brat, but it sounds like you made a point of seeing as much of the country as you could.
Well, I didn't really have much experience with travel. Early on, living in Chicago, Abby and I took the kids to the Great Smoky Mountains. That was my first national park visit after I had kids. And we really loved that experience, but I still didn't have sort of this national park bug until we actually hit the road. It wasn't the National Park Service and public lands weren't really something that I had thought that much about until I started getting to some of them and really visiting them and understanding how special they are.
So what captured your imagination? What was it that you saw that that turned you on to wanting to do, to make this a full-time thing?
Well, I think when you start visiting some of these places, I guess my perception of them before going into it was that it's just a large park. It's a national park. It's just the same as your local city park, but it's for the nation. And what I started to realize when you start to visit some of them is that they all have different purposes in our history. They all have different meanings. And the National Park Service and national parks are really a way to not just preserve American landscape from, you know, from development, from deforestation, all that sort of stuff. But they're also a place where we preserve our history, where we have just, with there's 433 National Park Service sites, and they're everything from Yosemite and Yellowstone to places like Alcatraz and the Gateway Arch and all of the memorials in DC. And they're places that recognize our really complicated history and some of the things that we've done to overcome some of that complicated history across the country.
You're so right about how different they are. My family, you just reminded me, my family, we took our children to see Alcatraz, and I'm now, you're reminding me, that is National Park Service property. Couldn't be a more different place from Yellowstone or Yosemite than that.
Alcatraz is really interesting to me because it's part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And you've got the Golden Gate Bridge there, of course, and you've got Alcatraz Island, and then there's some other islands involved, and there's some landscape involved. Actually, just recently, there was a coyote found on Alcatraz Island. So there was this big effort to try to figure out how this coyote got to Alcatraz Island. And they set up trail cameras, and they learned that it swam across just like the escapees from Alcatraz.
No, really? Oh, my gosh. Well, so we've been reading in, and we gather that there's been kind of a revival lately of people being more interested in visiting parks.
Well, there's been this big explosion in visitation and just road trip travel in general. And a lot of that has to do with COVID, but it goes back a little bit further. In 2016 was the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. And the government did a lot to sort of advertise the National Park Service, get people excited. Of course, there was lots of articles, and there were, you know, Good Morning America reports and things like that happening surrounding the national parks for the 100th anniversary. And the real sort of boom in national park travel, I think, began then. And then COVID hit, and we all got locked indoors for a while. And then we all realized that, oh, the great outdoors is kind of a way we can get out and about and go places safely. And road trip travel exploded. RVing exploded. So my day job is covering the RV industry now. And RVing had this massive, massive boom in 2021, 2022, partly because people were itching to get out and about, but also, you know, they had stimulus checks in their pocket. They had money that they were itching to spend, and people spent it and they started traveling. So the national parks really have seen this big boom. Last year was as pretty much each year before, it was the largest year for visitation in national parks. And it doesn't seem to be slowing down.
What about the public's perception of the park system? What do you find that people think it is, and then what does it turn out to be? As you said, I mean, it is varied. Every site is distinct and individual.
Well, it is complicated right now, because I think a lot of Americans think of public lands as places that are to be protected and to keep development out and all that sort of stuff. A lot of Americans look at public lands as places where they should be free to roam wherever they want, and the government should keep their arms off of. A lot of people look at them as resources, as places where we can go harvest wood and minerals and things like that. There's a lot of complications right now with the desire for people to want to go tour these places uninhibited. And that conflicted with the amount of people wanting to do it. So there's been a whole lot of talk and administrative changes surrounding these timed entry reservations over the last few years. So there, a lot of the big national parks have instituted reservation systems where in advance you have to book the time and day that you're going to go in. And some people think that is, you know, that is an infringement on their rights. And some people think, oh, that's great, I get to know that I'm actually going to be able to enter this park on my vacation day. And then there's the broad story happening right now surrounding the stories that we tell in these parks and the signage and the exhibits about our history and about the complicated stuff in our history, mostly surrounding the Civil War and slavery and Native American removal. And there have been, you know, efforts by the Trump administration to remove some of that signage, to change some of the language, to remove things that might remind us of some of those sorts of things. And then on the other side, you have this this desire to remove some of these Civil War monuments across the country. That tension between those the different sides of that argument has been going on for the better part of the last decade, along with then presidents deciding to create national monuments and take them away. A lot of our National Park Service sites are national monuments.
We've covered actually in our series this year, America at a Crossroads, in our 250th year, we've looked at some of the conflict between the administration and others over the National Park Service, and it is very much at the center of conversation and discussion. Where do you see that?
Yeah, it's an interesting test. The National Park System in general is complicated. I think there's this idea that it was always something, and then Trump has come in and it's sort of thrown things up in the air a bit. And part of that is true, that he has been the first president to try to reduce a national monument in scale. And national monuments being interesting because a president can set a national monument just by declaring so, whereas a national park, what we like to call the capital N, capital P national parks, are designated by Congress, and you know that takes an act of Congress. But there actually is a kind of a long history of the complication of these sites and why they were created. We think of them as like sort of special temples to nature, and a lot of times, you know, they're created because a couple of senators in a state want tourism in their area, and that's what happens. It doesn't mean these sites weren't special in the first place, but there has been this sort of complication over those sites over the history of the National Park Service. On the ground, I think a lot of this conversation happens online. I think people that are actually visiting these spaces aren't really concerned with it in any way. In terms of, they're not concerned that they're getting pummeled by too many images of slavery and Native American removal and all that sort of stuff. I think people are smarter than our politicians like to think they are, than their opponents in the sort of online argument sphere think they are. I think people can hold multitudes of complex issues at one time, and I think they're comfortable going into these spaces knowing that there are complex issues that shaped them over the course of the years, and I can go to them and I can decide to focus on what I want to focus on. I can enjoy them while knowing about the complicated history of them.
No question that people in many instances are a lot smarter than they've been given credit for by the politicians. But you know, and speaking of the history behind some of these stories, you in a recent podcast you did for Parkography, you zeroed in on Mount Rushmore and the story there. And we don't have time to go into the whole thing, but it's much more interesting and fascinating, in fact, than most people realize. People think, oh, it's a carving of the faces of some U.S. presidents, but there's more to that story, isn't there?
Yeah, it wasn't even originally intended to be this sort of presidential monument. It wasn't intended to be it's kind of like a second Statue of Liberty in a way in the Midwest. It was originally intended, again, to drive tourism. A historian in South Dakota named Doan Robinson originally had this idea to carve these spire formations in the Black Hills of South Dakota as sort of Western figures like Buffalo Bill and Lewis and Clark. And that you would kind of come here and you would drive through a highway and you would see these giant spire formations that were carved of these people. And They ended up contracting a guy named Gutzon Borglum to come and carve it. And he decided that these spires weren't going to be able to hold anything, that they wouldn't be able to carve them. And he zeroed in on this mountain called Mount Rushmore, which is known by the Lakota people as the Six Grandfathers. It actually looked like people before it was carved. And he decides, I'm going to put presidents on it. So it kind of by happenstance became this memorial to the idea of the presidency of the United States. And Gutzon Borglum had some history himself. He came from carving Stone Mountain in Georgia, which is a
notorious.
It was notorious for representing the Civil War, and it's also where the second founding of the where the founding of the second KKK happened. And Borglum had ties to the KKK. So there's this complex history of the artist, Gutzon Borglum. The taking of this land, the entire Black Hills was deeded to the Lakota people before it was taken away from them again. And then putting these presidential figures on it that sort of overlook the land. And then the whole idea of just carving a mountain in the first place, of taking something natural and blasting into it with dynamite and all that, it's a complicated thing. But I think you can still go there and visit and understand all of those things, and you can still appreciate it. At least for me, I can go there and appreciate the 400 people that walked up 700 steps every day, that risked their lives hanging from these no more than two ropes and a board, with big drills to carve the faces in Mount Rushmore over the course of several years. There's challenges there, and it's great to learn about them. I think it's great to celebrate the strides that we've made and the changes that we've made in the course of American history.
No question. And that's one example. I mean, the connection between that, as you say, and Stone Mountain, most people certainly are not aware of that. But the idea that you're right, that today we would go and carve an image into a piece of natural rock and call it a national monument or a national park is kind of hard to imagine that we would do that all over again. But there's history in other places too. You were telling us about Fort Sumter, the story there and other places. Do you have favorites that you'd like to share that you've been to over and over again?
Yeah, Fort Sumter is really interesting because it's, you know, one of these cool coastal forts. We have all these coastal forts along the East Coast where they were sort of built right after first the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812 to protect from, of course, battleships. And during the Civil War, it was very clear that they were absolutely useless. But Fort Sumter is where the first shots of the Civil War were fired. And when you go there and you visit and you experience it, you take a tour out there, you get on a boat and ranger takes you through the place, and they invariably show you the bricks that the fort is built out of. And these bricks were forged by enslaved people. And when you go look closely at them, you see in the bricks fingerprints, and not just fingerprints of enslaved people, but enslaved children. And you know, you can look at sculptures of people all day. A sculpture is a representation of somebody's idea of what somebody looked like. When you see somebody's fingerprint in something, it's sort of this indelible idea that they were there. And it really brings home sort of this idea of what the Civil War was fought for at the place where it began. So I love that history. I love White Sands National Monument. White Sands in New Mexico is our children's favorite place in the National Park Service. They feel like they're in an episode of Star Wars. It's one of the few parks, most of the parks, you got to stay on a trail, right? At White Sands, you can just kind of go anywhere you want to. And it is these weird white gypsum dunes. It's not actual sand, it's gypsum, which is what drywall is made out of, in the middle of New Mexico that sort of contrasts completely with the landscape. And at White Sands, they found the oldest human footprints in existence. White Sands, just in the last couple of years, they found footprints in White Sands that make humans older than we thought they were in the United States. And so the human history goes way, way back, right? It's beyond the Native Americans, and it goes very far back in the National Park Service. But then this White Sands missile site, which is right next door, is also where the atomic bomb was tested. And in White Sands National Park and in areas around it, you can still find slivers of green glass, which was instantly formed when the atomic bomb was first tested. So again, beautiful natural area that is sort of this surprise out of the middle of nowhere, but has this wild human history to it. I love places like that. And then there's some complicated stuff with the creation of some of these parks. The National Park Service and some of the states involved did some things in the creation of some of these parks that we would look on today as not so nice. Shenandoah National Park, there were some 400 to 500 Appalachian families that had their homes taken away from them to create Shenandoah National Park. And it was sold as a humanitarian effort where they were actually saving these people by, you know, taking their homes away from them. There's similar situations. Yeah. Voyageurs National Park, a lot of homes were taken by eminent domain to create Voyageurs National Park up in Minnesota. There's a lot of complications that derive from the creation of some of these parks. And we've learned a lot of lessons over the years, and we do things differently now, we like to think, than we might have done 75-100 years ago.
We were reminded that this is the year that Route 66 turns 100. So the national highway system clearly had something to do with people's ability to get around, to see these parks. How do you see the growth of, I don't know, car travel in this country and our ability to experience the country?
Well, yeah, the National Park Service was founded just 10 years before Route 66. And Route 66 comes at the time when not only are we making highways more accessible, but the car becomes democratized and a lot of people can afford to own a car and people start to travel. And it is really this wholly American thing. Road trip travel, yeah, that really began in the early 20th century and inspired a lot of people through postcards and photographs to visit some of these places. I mean, we have to remember, we couldn't watch YouTube and see people visit these places back then. All you would really get was black and white photographs and, you know, sometimes a film here or there. And it was a time where people could say, I'm one of the few people, I'm the only person on my block that has been to Yellowstone, and I get to tell everybody about it. And over the course of the last century, Route 66 being on its 100th anniversary this year, the same year as the 250th anniversary of the country, the growth of road trip travel is just, it's tied directly to the expansion of the national park system. And Route 66 has several parks. In fact, there's one park, Petrified Forest, you drive right through on Route 66. Route 66 now, to me, it's mostly highway, right? It's interstates. And it's still a lot of exits McDonald's.
It's Chicago to the West, Southern California,
Chicago
right?
It's Chicago to yeah, the Santa Monica Pier. And it is I've driven it in different chunks and not all at once. And it is all interstate. It's just like anywhere else. Every exit is the same gas stations and fast food restaurants, but you can get off the road a bit and visit some of these wonderful sites. But Route 66 was designed to visit some of these places. It was designed to take you by the Grand Canyon. It was designed to take you through Petrified Forest. There was this idea that we were building these roads not just for people to get from A to B. You know, Chicago was the second city. It was the second largest city in the country, and LA would become the second largest city in the country, but it wasn't back then. And Route 66 linked them in a drive that was meant to get you there, but also get you there in an interesting way that took you by some of the best that the American West had to offer.
And Route 66, again, so iconically American, that this idea that you can get in your car and go across the country and nobody's stopping you, nobody's checking your identity card. You have the freedom to explore the country. It seems to me it is. Is it uniquely American? Are there other parts of the world doing what we do?
Well, I think other countries, I've seen this a lot in the social media discourse, where a lot of Europeans don't quite understand why we drive everywhere and why we don't have trains to get us places. And there are certainly lessons there where we could spend some more money on some public infrastructure, but they might not understand how big this country is.
But as I said a minute ago, it's hard for me to think of another country where you read about people getting on the road and traveling. I'm sure they can go to the beaches or the mountains or whatever in Europe and other parts of the world, but it seems to me we have something kind of special.
Our infrastructure here was really built on cars. It's a lot of it has to do with the timing, and a lot of it has to do with our with Henry Ford and again democratizing cars and this sort of the era post World War II, where Americans were looking to get out and explore, and there was some financial freedom, and it just kind of sort of worked out that way in a lot of ways. And there are other countries where, there are smaller countries certainly where road tripping is popular. New Zealand, I know, is one of them. But in terms of the sheer size, I mean, it's hard to beat the United States and the entire continent.
I'm thinking of something, Jason, about, at a time when the country is so polarized, something we've spent a lot of time in America at a crossroads looking at, whether are the parks providing some sort of equalizing sauce to where we are today, in that they can throw people together from all kinds of backgrounds, and not just geographically, but different economic circumstances, different political views. What do you see when you think about the places people stop to visit?
Well, we essentially lived in campgrounds for 7 years straight, and we still get out a ton. We got 100 days last year on the road, and yes, especially campgrounds. The whole idea of a campground too is also, I mean, camping obviously dates back to the cave people, but the idea of the campground as we know it today is also sort of an American creation that comes from car travel. And campgrounds are really interesting because different than a hotel. You go to a hotel, you go to your room, and you don't expect to really interact with anybody other than perhaps at the lobby bar or something like that. But you're not seeing them when you're coming out to, to sit and read a book. You're not interacting with all of the other people that are staying at the hotel. But a campground is sort of more like a mini neighborhood where, with a lot of transient people that are coming in and out. And it is people of all stripes. It is people of all, you're right, economic brackets, people staying in tents, people in a, million-dollar motorhome in the same park. And they are from different political beliefs. They're from different countries. And yeah, I think it is, when you're in a space like that, especially on vacation, where everybody is kind of in a vacation mood, it just is, I think it brings you back to a different time. It brings me back to the pre-internet days when, bring the back to school days when you're in school with a whole bunch of different people of all different stripes, where everybody sort of, sometimes there are challenges, sometimes people don't get along, but if somebody has a problem, there's five people running over with tools to help. If somebody's having a hard time backing into a site, somebody's there to offer assistance. Somebody's having a hard time putting a tent together, somebody's offering them assistance. You talk to people on your morning walk, you're out walking the dogs or something like that, people will tell you, there was a bear over at this overlook yesterday, make sure to head over there. The moose are hanging out over here today, make sure to head over there. And there, it is a very communal atmosphere. And it is, I think, one of the few places where we actually have that. When you're out in a national parks or somewhere like Yellowstone, everybody there is learning anew what they're doing there. And it is a very communal space where people are having a good time and they're getting along. I mean, it's not usually a space where there are a whole lot of challenges. And I think people are in person, you know, you're willing to talk to somebody with empathy when you're in front of mm-hmm. them. When you have that person right there, you see them as a human. And when they are digits on a screen, you don't. And we get into we're being more and more polarized in the digital space. But I think that the reality in the in-person space still exists. And it's really visible to me in the American campground.
Well, that gives me hope. You know, so you could argue we need more campgrounds to help chip away at our polarization. But thinking about the future, what are the challenges facing the park service, the park system? I mean, a lot of people are out. As you said, last year was the most visitors of any year ever. Yeah. Are we overwhelming the park system, especially at a time of strained federal dollars?
We tend to overwhelm it, and the federal budget has been a problem in recent years. I mean, the National Park Service is always been underfunded. It's an interesting challenge because national parks and the National Park Service are one of the few issues that are very popular on both sides of the aisle. And it tends to be pretty easy to get supportive legislation through Congress. Is one of the few areas where there have been some real successes that both sides can point to over the course of the last 20 years or so. But at the same time, even the first Trump administration, the Great American Outdoors Act was passed through a Republican Congress that put a lot of money into, and we're seeing a lot of that money being put into place just now, into repairing this huge backlog that the National Park Service had of deferred maintenance, something like $13.5 billion yes. it was at the time, at least. And that we're only beginning to see some of the fruits of that labor. We're seeing a lot of campgrounds renovated, a lot of visitor centers being renovated and roads being rehabilitated, stuff like that. But then at the same time, the second Trump administration comes in, and with DOGE, there's this whole attempt to get rid of as many federal workers as possible. And there's this idea that there's a lot of people sitting around on the payroll, not only across the federal government, but particularly for the National Park Service, it's a problem because it's one of the few places where we interface with federal employees. We don't typically talk to IRS agents unless we're.
Oh, that's such unlucky. A good point.
You know, so yeah, we're seeing them there, and a lot of people have opinions. They see somebody sitting at a desk, and they think, oh, they should be out working, doing something on a trail or something like that. There are a lot of opinions about the types of work that these people are doing. Whether we should have scientists doing natural research in the parks, and we should be spending the money on that. But the way this sort of reduction in force happened, and the way it kind of had to happen, was to just try to get people to leave that were close to retirement. Mm. So some of your people with the most institutional knowledge, and then try to get people to leave force people to leave that were in the probationary period. So they've only been in the Park Service for a year or two, and they're some of the most motivated people. So what actually end up happening is we lose about 25% of the National Park Service workforce. And in that process, we lose some of the very best people. We're not, if you want to make the argument that there are people that need to go that aren't pulling their weight or whatever it might be, that's not what happened. People weren't evaluated based on their merits. And their contributions. So what we have is a situation where we have far fewer people working in the National Park Service doing the same number of jobs and covering lots of areas and with less institutional knowledge. And frankly, less like fee collection. We go to a booth and there's a lot of fee booths empty and things like that. And there's a lot of restrooms that aren't getting cleaned and that sort of stuff. And a lot of that hasn't been as bad, I will say, as a lot of people had thought that it might be. But I do fear that we won't see the worst of what this reduction in force has done for many, many years to come. Things don't deteriorate at a pace that is obvious. When maintenance is not happening, 10 years from now, we're wondering, why is whatever administration in place 10 years from now letting these parks deteriorate? When it usually is sourced back to something prior. And there have been issues from both parties with the protection of some of these sites and the allowing the backlog to get so bad to allow places to deteriorate. But my view is that these places, I'm not the first to say that national parks are America's greatest idea. I think they're more than that. I think they're our front lawn. I think they are where the rest of the world comes to experience America, whether that's Yosemite and Yellowstone or the DC parks, and I commend the Trump administration for some of the improvements that they're making in some of the DC parks. I think that they're not doing it. They're not going through the proper channels where you're supposed to have the environmental reviews and all that sort of stuff. But the idea of spending money to improve some of the things that are broken and need replaced and fixed in some of our National Park Service sites, I think is important. But I think these places should be shrines to nature, to our history, to America. And you can, whoever you are from around the world or from within the country, you can go to them and experience them and experience the best that America has to offer. And sometimes that land is exactly what you expect. Sometimes it looks back at you as something different and shares with you our history in a different way and opens you up to understanding the world and our history and our place in this, on this big rock that you might not have understood in the same way.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end our conversation than that, than thinking about what these parks say about our country and what they say about our 250th and how important it is to preserve them, to appreciate them, respect them, and go see them, but don't love them to death, don't overwhelm them.
There's so many options.
We need to take care of them.
You can go to so many places. You don't just have to go to Yellowstone. There's so many things to see.
You're right. There's so many places to go. This has just been spectacular, Jason. Thank you so much. We've learned a lot about not just the national park system, but about your love of these places and about how important it is to pay attention to the history. We appreciate the beauty of these lands, and it is so important to understand the history that's involved. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Judy.